from Saskatchewan, Treaty 6 territory. And this is a blend of indie, hip-hop, and a smidge of electronica. Nige B is amazing. Met him at the airport when he was coming back from Louisiana, and I was coming from, I don't know where I was coming from, but I was coming from somewhere. And what a lovely, lovely person he and his girlfriend were. We got a little snap at Pearson, and off they went and off I went. We're going to play something called Morning Drive, featuring Dubby Goat Bars. And right now I'd like to play music from an artist born in West Auckland, New Zealand. And this artist is Moe Allen and is of Maori descent. We're going to play a song called My Love, which came out in the fall of 2024. This is a really interesting thing that I think you'll like. And this is an opportunity to connect with music from across the world. So here we go. Here it is on the jukebox.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. The Metal March returns again in 2025, featuring 10 hours of live bands and DJ sets from your favorite KBOO metal hosts. March 4th and support metal on KBOO. Text KBOO to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/give to donate and tune in to the Metal March Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Metal takes over the airwaves for the Metal March Metal Marathon, only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. From its founding, KBOO's purpose has been to serve as a community-driven alternative to mainstream media. In a new year, with numerous executive orders from a new presidential administration and the rise of misinformation, KBOO affirms its duty to serve its community. KBOO, its programmers, volunteers, and staff do this by bringing you accurate information, by giving space to underrepresented voices, and by uplifting arts and culture. In these uncertain times, KBOO seeks to be a guiding light for those who are scared, those who are affected, and those who are fighting the good fight. KBOO stands with the immigrant community, the LGBTQIA+ community, the disability community, and all of those affected by the new administration. We stand here at 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in the Corvallis-Philomath area, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and at KBOO.fm.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before talking about a subject. To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people. It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. On yesterday's show, we continued our series, the Build and Fight Formula series that has been put together by Kali Ankuno and Cooperation Jackson, along with Thande Chimaringa, who is a journalist, an organizer, activist, and author from our sister station in KPFK in LA. We played the second lecture, and today we are going to let you hear the Q&A portion. They'll be reading off the questions from the audience, and the Q&A, I think, is just as compelling as the lecture. So strap in as we continue this series, Build and Fight formula. You can get more information at cooperationjackson.org. And without further ado, let's listen to some more of Kali Nkuno and Thandi Chimurenga.
How do you feel about the thesis of neo-feudalism, that is the consumption of surplus value rather than the reinvestment of surplus value?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think there are elements of that clearly taking place. I know some people on here have been monitoring some of my arguments and work for years, so y'all might remember, like in 2018 and 2019, I was kind of raising a question, you know, on Facebook and other places about was tech kind of what I was calling, was it in the pole position over finance? And that was, you know, what I was trying to argue, I think, is for at that time, without having the words and not being able to have the time to do all the research necessary. I think I would encourage folks to look at Yannis Varoufakis' book around techno-feudalism. As I think, not that I agree with all of his points, but I do align what I would say about 85 of what I've read and heard. And some of the things he's been articulating in videos, I would encourage you to check it out. I actually agree with more how he articulates it in some of his more recent media interviews than how he did it in the book. But read the book. It's good.
This is the brother who was a former government minister in Greece.
Who quit once the Syriza government capitulated to the Germans and the European bank.
Can you spell his last name?
Huh?
Can you spell his last name?
I cannot.
Okay. I'm busy, which is why I can't.
Varoufakis.
Work it out, y'all. Work it out.
Yeah,
Google is your friend.
Yannis Varoufakis is Varoufakis, I think.
AI might help us out. So that, yeah,
you know, English is not my strong language.
Here's another question.
But what's the next question? But I would say, check that out, because I think for the person who was asking that question in short, check it out. I think we are definitely moving in that direction. I think definitely if you look at what the tech lords and how they have aligned themselves with the MAGA movement to a degree, or at least aligned themselves with Trump, because it's not clear that all the sections of MAGA, it is very clear that not all the sections of MAGA like Steve Bannon are in alignment with them, and they're actually struggling with each other, and we have to find some way to accentuate that struggle and heighten those contradictions. But check it out, you know, what they're doing, what they're planning, and why they are trying to dismantle the government and what they're planning on replace it with. They're trying to replace it with their digital platform so that they are ultimately in control of all the various forms of governance and commerce. And you have this whole platform where they are like Amazon, what thing that Yannis argues, that Amazon has basically become the market in that producers are producing for them. And it's Amazon which is determining prices, not even the market in the old abstract sense. So I definitely think that we are in a period of transition, and there's going to be an intense struggle to figure out how it either a new system is going to emerge because we force it to emerge, or they're going to impose a new system, and we see some of the basic elements of its existence through institutions like Amazon and Alibaba and things like that. So we need some organizations and some conscious intentional fighting and creating the alternative.
Okay. Are there any good documentaries that cover these mutual aid efforts during Katrina? And I would also mention, you know, there was Katrina, I think for many of us, because Katrina, the internet, YouTube in particular, was still young. We didn't really hear about that word mutual aid. But since 2020, and the aftermath of the George Floyd uprising, or during the George Floyd uprisings, we saw another explosion of mutual aid. That term came, I believe, more into public consciousness. And just recently here in January in California with the wildfires in Pasadena and Altadena,
right,
people once again talking about mutual aid.
And organizing some pretty broad and audacious things in California, folks not aware, in LA. So there's a bunch of mutual aid work going on there right now.
Right. So if there are no, if you, Kali, can't recommend the titles of any good documentaries, folks just look them up. I'm sure they're out there and there's some being produced.
I mean, to be honest with y'all, there's maybe, I can't remember the name of it. There's short clips that I would recommend, but whole documentaries. Having been there for 3 years on the ground right after that happened and living through it and trying to make a contribution, most of the things kind of got some of profoundly wrong. Spike Lee's two films were beautiful cinema, but bad politics. And missed the point, missed the margin on point, you know, like oftentimes on purpose, you know. But Spike has always kind of evaded offering a political solution. So he was consistent in doing that again.
Okay,
but
see, beautiful cinema. See, here's the thing. See, you can't be dropping these little bombs and then walk away.
You asked me a question, I got to answer.
Yeah, but see, we ain't got...
Let's move on. If you don't want, let's move on. So look up. There are some good, particular things. There's some good pieces. Common Ground had a good series of documentation, despite, you know, some of the issues and things that wind up emerging. It came out about like Brandon Darby, etc. There are some good things to look up that you can have in there. Definitely many videos, you know, that Malik kind of explained in the experience, or Scott Crowe and some of the other people. So there's things out there. There's a couple of good pieces out there by Brother Malcolm Suber that wind up happening. Some work that we did that I know is out there from the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and Survivors Village. There's stuff out there for folks to look up to kind of document that history. Democracy Now! Has some good interviews over the course of like the first 2 or 3 years that covers all those actors, and then some of the stuff that the Acorn Brother Steve Bradbury and them were doing for their efforts in Wade Rathke and some of those folks. So there's stuff that's out there. You got to kind of pick and choose. I think the pieces are better than anything that presented as a whole, but there's definitely stuff out there. And let me end with this, and so we can go on to the next question. I've seen some better videos. I'll leave it in the positive, Tandy. There's some really good videos that came out about the mutual aid work that happened in Puerto Rico over the last couple of years. I think they were much better politically than a lot of stuff that came out. And I'm talking about more full-length stuff. So look it up. I can't remember off the top of my head what some of those were. But they're more recent. They're like from the last, 6, 7 years from the last major hurricane there. Definitely look them up. And some are in Spanish with subtitles, but some are in English. And you can probably start looking up the woman who did Naomi Klein. Look up some of the stuff around Naomi Klein's, and then the plethora of stuff off of that. And then we can ask, you know, our comrade co-conspirator, Sister Rosa Clemente, who's Afro-Puerto Rican, Afro-Boricua, who was also involved directly in those efforts for her to send some resources to us, you know, and check out her view of that's also part of the work, Me, Tiny, Cooperation, Jackson, and Viewing, to give her a shout out in her contributions and her work. So there's things out there that people can look at and learn from, for sure.
Are there principles of unity or principles of transformation healing that could protect against infiltration and sabotage, thinking ahead a bit after the initial startup stages? For infiltration, no, they already here. Go ahead. Go ahead, Kali.
Are there principles of transformation and healing? Look, they're good.
Or unity.
There's best practices, but nothing that I know of absolutely stops infiltration.
Right.
And the way a lot of things are structured, let's be honest, y'all. One of the reasons, I'm going to go back to reinforcing the point. One of the reasons why we need to develop kind of tech sovereignty and independence in that media, like a lot of stuff, they don't even have to send infiltrators in the way that they used to. They just need these, right? And we carry these around. We utilize them. You know, this provides well enough where you at, who you connecting with, most of what you're talking about, you, all that stuff is there. So minimize your use, and we need to create a system that we on, you know, control, that's not subject to one day Apple deciding it gets a subpoena from the FBI, you know, let me get Tandy's information, and they willingly give it over, right? Or they put a tracer on your stuff. And some of that, people need to be mindful. There's enough tech out there that, you know, somebody kind of know what they're doing. They can monitor your phone from stuff that they can get from Best Buy. Sadly to say, you know, there are good practices, but there is no absolute way to kind of mindful of that. And also be mindful that, you know, good people turn too because of certain situations. Somebody get caught up with something and the state winds up turning them. Somebody winds up, you know, getting in some debt and somebody offers them some money and they wind up getting turned. So, you know, don't just think of it as they need to send infiltrators. They could turn people or people turn because of disagreements. So there's a, you know, creating healing transformative cultures and some of the work, I think some of the more modern movements and things that have come in particular from some of the best practices coming from the feminist movement and from the queer movement, I think around all the internal work and checking and checking the best aspects of checking for power and privilege and the democratic dynamics, those are things that we have to uphold in their best principles, not get lost in the abstract of, you know, trying to monitor and self police each other all the time. That's not the most healthy or transformative way, but there are things that we need to pick up from, I think, what some of the younger generation have been putting down the last 20, 30 years that build on the work, particularly of like, you know, the Black womanist and feminist movement and the general feminist movement and the environmental movement that speak to some of these practices in short.
Do you have thoughts about the use of legal organizing structures like LLCs, 501c3s, 501c6, 501c7, et cetera, to house entities for social reproduction?
Yes, but don't get dependent upon them, right? Don't put all your eggs in that basket. And if for no other reason, the Democrats left us a clear warning on why not to put all our eggs in those baskets. And what I'm speaking to is, you know, before Biden and them, you know, were shown the door, they laid down a series of laws that said that they were going to strip the nonprofit status of any organization they deemed to be supporting Palestinians and Palestinian resistance. That was the Democrats. Don't put that on Trump and the Republicans. That was the Democrats.
But I thought we had freedom of speech.
They're going to build on it, right? Because they don't like, you know, the power abhors a vacuum, and any good tool that they could use to punish the enemies, they're going to use. You know, I think there's a lot of groups, including ours, that are always already kind of scrambling, like, how do we make sure that we have a plethora of some of these institutions to at least make it hard for them to come at us? And if they take out one, not everything collapses.
But
all your eggs in these baskets. Recognize what their political limitations, what they can be used for, and what they should not be used for. Because that's one of the mistakes I often see of people thinking that, you know, you have a
wait a minute, stop, hold on, no, stop. First Amendment freedom of speech, Kali.
What First Amendment is freedom of speech?
The Constitution says freedom of speech. It is the First Amendment.
I live in America, so do you. Ain't no freedom of speech.
What's the American Constitution?
All speech got a cost. All speech got a cost. Trump gonna teach us all that pretty quickly, right? So either you stand on the principle of what you believe and be willing to kind of sacrifice for that, or shut up. That's basically what we're getting down to.
In New England, we lack the land capacity to feed our entire population. This could be improved a lot, but I don't think we can get to 100% self-reliance. Do you foresee exchanges between regions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I see it, you know, not in a direct dimension around scaling up, but scaling out, and all of our work in these particular dimensions, federating. And why that's important, I think, in this particular period, and also learning from earlier efforts where things were too overly concentrated, and if they kind of took out the head or took out the command center, it all collapsed. We need more of a, you know, proliferation, so if they target one, not everything collapses. So, you know, there's a general principle around that, I think, in this period. But I think there could be, you know, kind of a broader, one of the pieces we try and incorporate, a broader bio-regional kind of dynamics and extended dynamics of folks finding out, like, what are the best things that can be produced in a particular area, and then figuring out how to trade. Because there's another dimension to what we're trying to do, is really work within the ecological capacities and limits of our planet. That's a critical thing that we're going to have to figure out how to do in this transformative dimension. And that's going to require a lot of degrowth kind of perspectives and dynamics, to just name it. And I encourage folks, if you never heard of that term, look up the degrowth movement. It's largely, as strong as articulations are in Europe, but there are adherents here and people, you know, promoting some folks up in the New England region, but particularly out of New York. Some comrades there have done some great little pamphlets, and we'll share and include in some of the materials that we promote. But definitely we're going to have to do a level of federation and mutual trade and exchanges. And we got to be mindful that, you know, it's only through the improvement of technology, containerization, freezers, and all this stuff that a lot of, that you can have bananas in New England and stuff now, right? You know, but if things are good, goods and services are moving from one end of the globe. Now, we may not want to continue that for the sake of the planet in the long term, at least the way it's being done now. But in the past, long before the capitalist system, folks were trading over long distances in different ways under different modes of production. I don't see why that necessarily needs to cease, except for if it's not done in a technologically efficient and environmentally sufficient way that continues to just put more carbon and methane and other stuff in the air that's going to kill us and our children, and make it so that we can't have grandchildren. That's what we kind of more or less have to worry about. But different ways to federate to meet some of those needs is absolutely going to be a critical part of what I think we need in the future. You're on mute, Tandy.
Do you see a need for a new communist party, a way to create a united front? I'm seeing more and more people calling for / seeking leadership.
Yes, but not necessarily one of the old school methods, right? So to be clear, I'm not one who per se will disavow the best aspects and practices of Leninism, for instance. I think that there's a lot of things within the Leninist tradition that are worth upholding, but there's a lot of things that are also worth discarding. And we need to be clear about the two and understand the difference between the two and what I mean. So one, you know, if you get to a central point wherein there needs to be some degree of frontal exchange and challenge to seize state power, then oftentimes the Leninist methods of organizing are going to be your best tools for doing so. But are they the best tools for transforming society? I would arguably have to say no. I think we've learned that military type structures and orders are not the best for eliciting the broad democratic expression of people's will. So we need to know what these forms are good for and what they are not good for, and when to use them and when not to. So we got to create new forms, which don't mean we discard or devalue the old, but we definitely have to, you know, be the champions of the new. And one of the things that I'll uphold from a paper that, you know, contributed to a role called Shifting Focus, I still fundamentally believe that the left needs to be the champion of democracy. But that doesn't mean that we are upholding bourgeois law and rationality at all, right? I don't mean upholding elections and all that other kind of stuff, but the broad democratic practice of democratizing society is what I mean. And our parties and structures need to reflect that. United Front, absolutely, but please do not confuse that with popular fronts. A lot of people are now running around talking about United Fronts and what they really mean are popular fronts, and as in multi-class, you know, or cross-class alliances. Not that all cross-class alliances should be frowned upon or looked down upon, but there needs to be fundamental questions around who's in the leadership and who's dictating the agenda. And oftentimes in most of these multi-class alliances, how they articulate, how they move, you know, we wind up articulating arguments which are about not scaring, you know, the petty bourgeois and in the elite, as opposed to us meeting our needs, or sometimes thinking that we can meet their needs and our needs at the same time. And oftentimes that's not possible, right? I can't meet my fundamental needs if I'm continuing to allow you to own and control everything, right? That's not fundamentally meeting my need. So we got some issues that just ain't gonna align, and we need to be clear about that. So there may be some tactical engagements we engage, but kind of keeping a proper front in perpetuity only means that you keep the capitalism in place, and we cannot evade ultimately the class struggle. So we need to be very clear and mindful about what types of alliances and fronts that we want to articulate and be a part of.
Is it possible to squeeze out the social relations of capital without a more explicit struggle and contestation for political power? Won't we have to assume governing power over some territory?
Absolutely. But I think it's a question order of operations. And it's maybe one of the more controversial arguments that this theory or this proposal, if you would, kind of puts forward. And let me kind of articulate what I mean. I was going to bring this up earlier, but because of the essence of time, decided to leave that alone and come back to it at a later date. But, you know, for most, again, you know, like the kind of standard, it got most attributed to the Leninist tradition. And it's not exactly where it comes from. I think, you know, that tradition refined it. But there was a general kind of notion in the communist and the socialist movements and the national liberation movements, you know, particularly those in Africa and Asia. The left forces there kind of had this general articulation that the first thing that we need to do was build enough strength and capacity to seize state power. Then, two, you seize the economy, and then you struggle to create, you know, equitable conditions and human rights within your society. I'm not necessarily that was wrong in a period where we were able to build mass political parties. We don't, again, live in that era. So we have to start from the era in which we live, and that is requires more of working with building federated groups that are aligned going in the same direction. And what this argument fundamentally is saying for is that we start by trying to re-articulate the economy, and we work on transforming the economy from below, occupying as much space, territory, you know, both within the market and society, changing the rules, changing the dynamics, creating the alternatives to outpace it. But that piece, you know, Mike and everybody be clear, the subtle argument around you're going to have to defend what you build is where the more explicit struggle and the contestation of political power ultimately is going to get to. We cannot evade that. We cannot skip it. We're not going to leapfrog it. And so what I'm calling, you know, there's the practices of position and the practice of maneuver, which is later on in this series. The practices of maneuver after getting to that point of being able to build the capacity to defend ourselves at scale and having the institutions of democratic governance, you know, whether it's horizontal governance or a Soviet, if you would, to use another term for some basically the same thing. That's where you begin to have to kind of deal with both the forces of state and capital, which are going to try to stomp us out. And believe me, that is what they're going to try to do if and when we get to that point. So you can't evade this. It's just a question of what are the tools and techniques we can build given where folks' consciousness is at, the level of organization, both that we're trying to build and what we're trying to scale out to, what that will enable. But, you know, I know, you know, Comrade Mike, and you've heard me say this before, ultimately it's a question of when we're going to go to battle with the state, not if we're going to go to battle with the state. And on whose terms? When and on whose terms is that battle going to be fought? I would hope it would be fought because, let me put it this way, you know, we've learned how to do enough self-governance, self-control, reach some productive capacities to feed our own people, and i.e., you know, feed our own army, that we get to that point of challenging as their, you know, system is rotting and decaying and they in serious war and conflict with each other. And this is what I mean by this, just to say quickly what I was saying earlier from the beginning. Exploiting, are we going to put ourselves in a position to exploit the contradictions that exist? And rest assured, y'all, this period of confusion, like this is a period of confusion amongst the ruling class, because we haven't been strong enough to really challenge them to do something different. So when you see Trump and these Democrats fighting, that's because they not aligned. They don't see how to get to, you know, to where they both kind of want to go in alignment with each other. But we shouldn't discount their points of unity. They just have differences on how they want to get there. So what I mean by that, they both are in total alignment, total agreement. You know, this is the U.S. imperative, that they're going to go to war with China. And if they need to take out Iran as a stepping stone to get there, they both in alignment and agreement to do that. But how to get there and who to align with is where they have some major disagreements. So like Trump thinking he's going to, you know, take on China without NATO. Like, are you serious? I don't see how you win that when you don't produce enough, you know, to basically take care of your own country, and they can produce whatever the hell they want almost in the blink of an eye. Like, you losing that race and trying to shut out your enemies or shut out your friends and make all your friends bow down to you is not the most efficient way. Because some of them might say, well, if it's a real contest, I might choose to go with China. So, but the fact that we even, these questions are being posed speak to some profound contradictions. We have to figure out how to step in with our self-organization to intervene, not to play in that great game, but to be like, well, y'all doing your thing, we're going to do our thing. And if we want a different world that don't involve having to go to war with anybody on those terms.
What should be our main takeaways when trying to establish mutual aid networks after ascertaining needs, given that consumers are atomized and maybe less inclined to struggle with other workers?
Good question. We want another hour, Tandy, or we want to bring that on? I'm asking you seriously.
No.
This
because of attention spans and Mr. and Mrs. Arthritis.
All right, well, Clarissa and everybody, no excuse. We will try to handle some of that in writing and cover that in other sections and other forms. But I would say the main, you know, in this era, let me put it down, in this era where a lot of what is being done in many respects is more direct aid and mutual aid. The critical piece is how do we elicit people from wherever they're at to be engaged in the process of distribution, organization of the activities, so we can begin to change some of the habits. And one of the pieces that I didn't speak to about why to start here is one of the things that we've seen in the last 20 years, I would say, but particularly during the pandemic, there was a real proliferation of mutual aid stuff. There was a real explosion of mutual aid networks. People, you know, farmers taking stuff directly, like in the Midwest, there was a pretty extensive network that wound up being built where farmers bypassed going to the grocery stores and going to the wholesalers and just start distributing food directly to people in the communities, right? To kind of bypass all that middle person stuff. Lot of lessons to be learned there. But the greatest thing that where a part of this argument grows from that experience, at least from my point of view, because it demonstrated that the tremendous amount of socialization the last 30 years under the neoliberal order did not totally atomize us, that there's still a broad human need for social and communal relations with each other, and that during a few times of crisis that breaks through. So how do we try to build this in a more permanent level wound up being one of the first arguments, and why I said we got to start here, because we're trying to create a new culture. And the mutual aid practices in the broad way is the first fundamental basis of creating that new culture. So I'll leave it at that, and then we can build on that down the road. So hopefully that suffices as a partial kind of explanation, but a lot more to say on that, you know, down the road.
Brother Matef put in the chat, the book is called Techno-Feudalism.
Thank you.
What Killed Capitalism, and that's how you spell his name, Yiannis Varoufakis. How to guard against liberalism and NGOization when mutual aid expands, and how to keep it militant.
If Fundamental question, Brandon. Mm-hmm. Yes. Despite Tandy playing the role of disciplining me, which I greatly appreciate.
I'm trying
to keep me on point. My deviations are in part to address some of your what you are raising here, Brandon, which is that we constantly have to be mindful of the political struggle that we are involved in. I think we have to learn how to engage better, myself included, in engaging political struggle, you know, and engage in the struggle for clarity, which is like I'm trying to offer you something that's not going to take us down a path of compromise or a path of, you know, concession or selling out, to put it frankly, but to do so in a manner that that hopefully people can learn from, do so in a manner that folks that we're trying to offer constructive criticism to, you know, hear and can respond to in a positive manner, you know, so that we all learn how to change our practice and our behavior accordingly, you know, to not fall victim to NGOization and you know, more charity models. But we constantly have to ask ourselves the question, and who's, whatever we're doing, and whose interest is this serving, and maybe even, you know, at time, why am I doing this? Is it leading to the greater kind of capacity building of the folks that I'm working with, or is it kind of providing a crutch or enabling, you know, different forms of dependency? Those are real questions I think we have to ask in this field to keep that political struggle in mind and keep the objective of, is this leading us to you know, liberation, or just kind of perpetuate more of the same? That's a constant struggle.
It seems daunting to need to build alternatives for everything into an uncertain future. But what if we only needed to build the structures that would allow mass labor strikes anytime, anywhere?
Labor strikes for what, Celine? And why I'm asking that question, I'm a call and response type person, but why I'm asking that question in that way, if the mass strikes aren't about ultimately workers seizing and dictating, you know, both the relations of production and creating a new mode, then you're just arguing for a greater cut of the pie. But the pie is rotten, so why you want to eat from a rotten pie and leave those folks in control? So it's not just around, like, the labor strike has to have a clear political objective that's beyond just better wages, working conditions. That's not going to cut it. If we leave them in control, then eventually 50, 40, you know, 100 years from now, they're going to start squeezing us again, finding new ways to exploit us again and extract from us again. That piece has to end. And there needs to be clear political consciousness that dictates how we want that to end, the timeline we want that to end, and what we're going to do to make it end. And yes, it is daunting, but this is, you know, the broad mission, I would say, is, you know, either we leave certain questions are constantly being answered by a parasitic, you know, state in a parasitic class, or we wind up answering ourselves, which one do we want to do? You know, and just speaking for myself, I don't want to leave any of that to them to settle, because it is not going to bode well. You know, just put it personally, it's not going to bode well for my children. God willing, in the future, grandchildren that may come.
Regarding appropriate agricultural ecological choices vis-a-vis each region, are we looking to center indigenous communities and follow their lead? I'm late today, so may have missed this earlier. Why were you late, Brooklyn Ravi? No, I'm just playing.
Let me make sure I'm reading this. Appropriate agriculture, ecological choices vis-a-vis region. Are we looking to center? Okay, I understood. Yes. I would argue And that is going to be one hell of a struggle. Let us be clear about that, right? Because there's a tremendous amount of unlearning, particularly those who are, you know, to use a term that may not be, you know, universal, but those of us on Turtle Island who aren't indigenous, there's some tremendous unlearning that all of us have to do, even Black folks have to do in that regard, to both learn, you know, what are the flows and cycles of this land, because the methods of production that you know, capitalism and the children, the settler colonial children have used, have intentionally, you know, ignored those cycles, destroyed many of them. And these are some of the things that we, all of us kind of, who don't come from those traditions and practices, we kind of employ, you know. So we're going to have to kind of, there's going to be a period of kind of unlearning that accompanies, and relearning some new methods that accompanies that kind of intentional and deliberate kind of degrowth kind of perspective to relearn this. And then we got to be mindful there's a deeper dimension of unlearning. And that deeper dimension is now, you know, climate change is here. It ain't like it's something that's coming, right? And its effects are already well underway. So, you know, the planting cycles, we do planting here. We do agriculture here. And we can tell y'all, just in the last 5 years, we can't plant in Mississippi like we used to plant the first 5 years of Cooperation Jackson's existence. And let me tell you why. The first 5 years, you know, from 2014 to like 2019, we didn't have freezes every winter. Did not have a one. I think we had a little one, like a surprise one that lasted 2 or 3 days in like 2018, right? But since 2019, every February, at least, right, January, February, there's a hard sale, not just 1 or 2 day freezes, like snow, sleet, ice, you know. And so the first couple of years, it caught us off guard, right? We didn't have, you know, hot houses already built or covering for the plants. In 2 or 3 years, we lost whole crops just because we weren't ready, or we planted something, we got prepared for the first freeze, and then the end of February, another one came. So we didn't, you know, plan anything. So I'm citing that to say that the cycles of what grows and how nature responding, like the planting thing is steadily, what you can plant and how warm it is and all that, part of it is steadily moving north year by year at this stage. So you can now grow things like up in New England, to cite an earlier kind of question, that you couldn't grow there 20, 30, you know, 50 years ago at all. But there's also ticks and all that other kind of stuff that once weren't there 30, 40 years ago that are now up there. But then you have now these weird polar vortexes that come all the way down to Texas and the Gulf of Mexico that we didn't have, you know, 10, 5 years ago. So we're going to have to relearn a number of different things in adjustment, you know, to the destructive pieces, the destructive cycles that have already been set in motion that disrupt some of the things that I think would come from some of the indigenous peace knowledge and techniques that we all need to learn. Now, I think that a critical thing is, the sooner we begin to make certain critical adjustments and you know, in this kind of dependency on the petrochemical, you know, complex and mode of production, we've seen again another critical lesson from the pandemic. This remarkable little blue-green planet that we live on has a tremendous amount of capacity to heal itself if we just stop, you know, violating basic things that it's telling us. And so we saw pretty quickly, much faster in that, what, two-year period, that a lot of things got cleaner. The air got cleaner. The water got cleaner. Wildlife started coming back in areas that ain't been in 100 years. Species started showing up, you know, just in a couple of months because of all the activity and stuff ratcheted down and people weren't outside, you know, with all the noise, pollution, and excess traffic and stuff. So, you know, we can do regenerative stuff. And the faster we adopt and take on this stuff, I think the more we heal. But it's a tremendous amount of healing that's going, I mean, learning and healing that's going to take place to get us to that point. So don't, you know, and I'm saying all this because this is an intense struggle within the left of oftentimes ignoring a lot of things that the left ignore. But this is one of those things, like, you know, social reproduction, women's labor, you know, the knowledge that come from queer ways of being, existing, learning the different layers and level, like all these things that we have to learn. This is another one of those critical pieces the left is going to have to grapple with and take serious.
I think this is a comment, not necessarily a question. Making the cities in circular shape and use automation of labor to reduce the marginal cost of every good and service, gradually to make them available free of charge, eliminating the need for trading.
Something that we're trying to ascribe to, and part of what this theory is articulating. So some of this, I think, we'll get into more a little bit later. And if you got some ideas on this, Brazel, you know, in future in pieces or even here, you know, please, or sources of recommendation, please include them so everybody can, you know, who engages can draw from those resources.
Then later on, he says, best way to do that is forming a group of people, creating a co-op, buying a piece of land in the name of the co-op, and building a new city in it. I think people are attempting to do that now.
Getting to that point for sure, right? And I think we, part of this argument is to extend that out, build, you know, because look, you know, just be mindful. We trying to win some people over. That's why I was trying to, you know, be mindful about doing this series. We're trying to win some people over because there's a bunch of folks who I think have appreciated, just looking at our work, who have appreciated some of the things that we contributed, but don't fully grasp or understand because it's all been written, hadn't all been written, or, you know, some of the things that have been focused on about the work down here in Jackson is more focused on, you know, the work around what was able to happen here in the electoral arena that often kind of bypasses what we've been struggling to accomplish in the economic arena, which, you know, is unfortunate, but, you know, this is an effort to kind of correct that practice. And, you know, for us to kind of detail both the challenges, and there are many, like this working, doing, trying to build a democratic culture practice and enhance our production. Like all this stuff is constant struggle. And even our work, I can tell you, goes in cycles, particularly like around, you know, farming and the way that we're trying to do it. You know, it's constant growth, constant learning, constant adjustment. And so we still constantly in the path of learning ourselves and trying to perfect our own practice. And that's going to be an ongoing thing. No matter how much we scale up, they're still going to be there.
I didn't mean to do all of that. I think I'm going to take two more questions. That's what I think. And the rest of y'all just going to have to tune in for session number 3 and bring your questions in. I'm looking forward to hearing how you understand dual power, perhaps as a way to weave together and synthesize Leninist and anarchist traditions, and as a way to safeguard against liberalism.
There's a whole, let me say right now, there's a whole section, I think in, correct me if I'm wrong, Tandy, or in October, no, November, that we're going to take on that question. And I'm really looking forward to that one because I believe I have contributed to some confusion in certain sections of the certain circles of the left, you know, on this question. And what I mean by that, I think there's been a way that I've heard, you know, like you hear feedback from things you put out there. I've
seen dual power and free the land. Dual power and free the land is in December.
In December, okay.
Democratize the economy is in November.
Okay. So yeah, okay. We'll get to that particular point, but I'll just say now that I think some of the things that I've seen out there about our frame of reference, and there's a good piece, I think one of the better pieces of criticism that I ever saw written. I have to put it up and pull it back out, and we wrote a little response, but the organization didn't fully agree, and then some other crisis moved on, so we never sent the response. So that's bad practice on my part. I'm glad I'm remembering this, and this will hold me accountable to sending that back, even though it's about like 2 years down the road. But a lot of the argument was framed in not understanding what we were articulating, and I think they were confusing that we were like trying to create like a little local utopia in our articulation of dual power, as if the settler state of Mississippi would allow something like that to happen. Was like, no, that's not what we articulated. At some point, even coming from the tradition that we come from, like, no, we when we say free the land, we mean that. And so this little experiment in municipalism was to aggregate power and learn. And I think we have learned a lot of stuff. Not that we all agree on it at this particular point, but I think we have learned a lot from, you know, like this 10-year run of this particular phase of the Jackson Kush plan. Some things to not do, some things to do. But I'll speak for myself. I was never not articulate something that didn't ultimately involve our forces actually seizing and displacing power. And I think where some of the confusion lies is I'm one who believes and as Marx said, in the intentional and deliberate withering way of the state, and what I'm arguing for are practices along the way that I think, you know, eliminate, hopefully, would eliminate some of the mistakes that happened in, say, like the Soviet experience, wherein, you know, there was no real broad democratization of kind of like the means of production and the transformation of society in a broad democratic way, and the power just wound up being totally centralized in the party, and the party was often substituted for the class, you know, which was, I think, a grave mistake, no matter how you slice that up. And so I think if we build a capacity of the class to do these different things, and not saying that they didn't, you know, that there's a lot of argument, you know, like they lost so many people during the war and the assault and all those different kind of things that you got to give an honest assessment of why certain things went down the way that they did. But I think there are certain institutions that are going to be needed at different phases of struggle, and then we're going to have to learn how to struggle with each other, that when one phase is over, to allow another one to kind of emerge and develop. But we're not overly relying on, you know, militaristic structures, but nor do we totally abandon our defense thinking that our enemies are just going to allow us to do what we want to do. That ain't how this works. Well, I want to say, Tandy, thank you again for trying to rein this in. Always wanted to, you know, and just to let folks know, me and Tandy have been having a back and forth about how much information, how much presentation, and I never feel like we cover enough or provide enough detail. But you know, of all the limitations, space-time limitation is the most oppressive. So, you know, hopefully this was short enough, concise enough that everybody got something out. There's still a whole bunch that I have written out, the materials I got here on the side that I would like to cover. So that will be hopefully in a book and in the writings and stuff to lead up to that. So be on the lookout. And we are still going to be doing, we got what, 9 more of these to go or 8 more of these to go?
Several.
Be on the lookout.
Several more. Yeah. Now, for people who want to get in touch with you outside of me, they ain't thinking about me, how do they get in touch with you, Kali?
The best way to reach me, you know, there's three principal ways. You can reach me on email, KaliAquino@gmail.com. I'm still on the Dinosaur Facebook, so you can find me there and chat with me up there and connect with me up there. I'm still giving Elon Musk money, at least for the time being. I'm migrating to some other of these platforms, even though they're all equally as bad in my opinion. You can find me on some of those, you know, and I do engage and go back and forth, and been taken very seriously reading through and got some comrades who are supporting me and going through all of the comments and feedback and trying to structure things. So hopefully folks saw that, some responses to that. We'll continue to try to do that. So putting things in this chat, if you want to put your contact information or a question, we will definitely get back to you. It may not be tomorrow or next week, but we will definitely get back because we're trying to refine this and hope it, you know, perfect it so it's, you know, it's got some social utility and provide things that people can use in the here and now.
We are doing this in conjunction with Cooperation Jackson, Black Liberation Media, of course, Rootwork, Rosa Clemente's channel. If you have not subscribed to Sister Rosa Clemente's channel,
Disrupt the
please
Chaos.
Subscribe to their channel, Disrupt the Chaos. I believe Hard Knock Radio.
That's right.
Terrestrial Radio, but Hard Knock Radio, which is coming out of Berkeley and KPFA, is also going to be joining in terms of helping to spread the message. So look for us.
And Democracy at Work. That's Rick Wolf's. And Democracy at Work. So those are the networks that we are using and platforms where we're getting this information out and trying to cross-pollinate and spread the message. And then for I'll promote this one for more kind of international pieces. There's a piece I want to try to start doing monthly in April with folks on a shifting focus kind of piece that'll be much more international in this kind of orientation. So be on the lookout for that one, and it'll be a part of this kind of rotation and stream.
All right. So the next one in this series will be in April. I believe it's April 8th. Is it, sir?
That is correct.
April 8th.
It's going to be on food sovereignty.
Food sovereignty. April 8th, 4 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. your central time, Kali, right?
That's right.
And 7 p.m. East Coast time, Tuesday, April 8th, right here on Black Liberation Media.
If you're tuning in, Hard Knock Radio, we're concluding the second portion of the Build and Fight Formula series. It's an educational series laying out some things that we should be thinking about in these troubled times. And it's put together by Kali Nkuno from Cooperation Jackson, along with Thandi Chimaringa from Black Liberation Media and our sister station on KPFK in LA. We're going to catch you tomorrow on Hard Knock Radio. We're out for now. Peace.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Bird Note. When humans first arrived on what is now Cuba, they would have encountered an ecosystem somewhat different than we know it today. The ancestors of the Guanahatabey people likely shared the island with sloths as big as black bears ambling through the open woodlands, monk seals lounging on the beaches, long-legged owls the size of children stalking the forest floor at night, and all of them living in the shadow of a giant. Gigantohyrax is an extinct genus of eagles whose fossils have been found in local cave deposits and tar seeps. They've left only scant remains, mostly leg bones, but the fossils show that these birds were heavily built and massive. With an estimated weight of nearly 30 pounds, Gigantohyrax suarezi, the larger of the two named species, would have been the biggest raptor known from the Americas, barely edged out by the similarly sized Haas eagle of New Zealand. This would make them 10 times heavier than the red-tailed hawk. Little else is known about Gigantohyrax, but forthcoming research may help us better understand the lifestyle and appearance of these awesome Antillean eagles and the lost ecosystem of the island they ruled. For Bird Note, I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin.
To KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of